Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you think that everything you're buying right now is costing you more, you would be right. As of August, the U.S. inflation rate was 5.3% compared to a year ago. That means consumer prices increased by 5.3% over this last year. This was driven by a 2.8% increase in the price of gasoline, a 1.2% increase in the price of new cars, and a 1.6% increase in utility costs. This rise in prices is faster than what the Federal Reserve would like to see, but it is in line with their current target of averaging 2% inflation over time. We've all noticed things cost more, and in some cases, the increases have been unsettling, even shocking, and that's because it's been a while since we've experienced this. So why now? What's driving this current price rise? And why do regulators assure us that this is only temporary, that prices should fall in 2022? How do they know that? Our guest this hour should have some answers. We're joined by Harry Bowen, professor of economics at Queen's University of Charlotte. Sarah House is senior economist at Wells Fargo. And Scott Horsley is the chief economics correspondent at NPR. Thank you all for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So Scott, let me begin with you. I mentioned that the Fed is predicting 2% inflation over time, but in the interim, gasoline, if you're at the pump, you know it's more costly. Beef prices are up more than 12%, though hotel and airline prices have gone down. Still, you say that even when inflation does settle down, it doesn't necessarily mean that prices will go back to their pre-pandemic levels. Some things might just level off at a new, higher price. Any clue about what areas of our personal economy that might impact?
Well, you mentioned, for example, gasoline and grocery prices. Those tend to bounce up and down a good bit, and we've seen them, you know, they fell, the gasoline prices fell really sharply early in the pandemic. Now they've more or less kind of come back to something, a more normal price range. Grocery prices are still up because people are doing more cooking at home and because all the people that produce our food are dealing with the challenges of doing so in what's still a pretty serious pandemic. But then there are other things which we've seen spikes which may reverse or may not. Lumber prices were something that soared early on and have now again gone back to something approaching normal. But higher car prices we could be dealing with for an extended period of time because of the challenges with the computer chips.
Yeah. Sarah, I mentioned that we're not familiar with this as consumers. Many people, young people, have never experienced inflation in their adult lives. So when was the last time we had any period of significant inflation, and what has been keeping it at bay until now?
Sure. Well, the last time we saw inflation at these levels for any persistent time, I think you'd really have to go back to the very early 90s. So probably late 1990, 1991 was the last time we saw what we call core inflation. So stripping out those volatile energy and food components that Scott just talked about. And the reason that we've had such low inflation over really the past three decades are multiple. So one, it has to do with the fact that we saw an even bigger period of inflation in the 1970s and 1980s, and the Fed worked really hard to bring down inflation. And they did it in a really painful way of raising interest rates, essentially inflicting a recession upon the economy. And so they had a lot more credibility going into the 1990s that if you saw inflation pick up, that the Fed would step in and help keep that in line. But we've also had massive things like productivity gains. So that helps keep prices down. It allows companies to pay workers more without having to raise costs. We also saw, of course, a big trend towards more globalization and greater integration in the global economies over the 90s, 2000s, and even early 2010s. And so that allowed some cost savings in terms of production. So particularly the prices of goods have been a big factor holding holding that down as well. So I think it's a combination of those productivity gains, globalization, and greater Fed credibility that kept inflation so low for the better part of the past three decades.
Prices, Dr. Bowen, rise when demand rises. And following the Great Recession, I would think that this demand for consumer goods was fairly high during all of the last 7 or 8 years. Why now? Is it just pent-up demand from being locked away for a good part of 18 months?
Well, I would say that you had that half right, that price increases can also happen because supply decreases, right? You can have an upward movement in supply, meaning a decrease in supply. I mean, I think, you know, that, you know, in general, we have this mixture of demand and supply factors. And what's sort of clouding everything at the moment is really trying to understand how much of the price changes are attributable to the so-called bottlenecks on the supply side. And I think Scott mentioned that in terms of the computer chip shortage and some of these things. And also something that's kind of mystified me, and maybe my colleagues can respond to, is you know, that we see, in fact, there was a large increase in restaurants and entertainment just recently. And yet the employment aspect there seems to have lagged considerably. And I've been trying to just think, why is it that people are not returning to work in these kinds of employment? What is the rationale? And we've heard many different explanations, but I'd be interested to just open that as a question to people to see what they think. Why are people not going back to serve as waiters and cooks in restaurants and in hotels and these kinds of things? Because this is part of the reason that the cost of those types of activities are rising.
You want to take?
Well, I've talked to a lot of restaurant owners and a fair number of current and former restaurant employees, and it is certainly been one of the interesting things to watch as we saw the sort of opening in the spring and summer. You know, a lot of restaurants that had been mostly doing takeout started serving indoor diners once again, and that meant a demand for more servers and that sort of thing. And the workforce was very slow to return. Of course, this was a part of the labor force that really suffered early on the pandemic. Bars and restaurants saw some of the biggest layoffs. Then they did see pretty strong job gains in June and July. They really led those strong job gains we saw in those months, but it still wasn't strong enough. Lots of restaurant owners were saying, you know, I need to hire 10 people and I've been able to hire two or three. There was some question about whether the supplemental unemployment benefits that were being paid out during the pandemic were contributing to that. Although, you know, we had this sort of interesting experiment this summer where half the states ended those benefits early, and they didn't really see a much stronger gain in employment than the states that kept paying them. So now those benefits have expired nationwide. We'll see what happens. And of course, with the Delta surge, some of that demand for workers in the up close and personal businesses like bars and restaurants has dropped off. We saw actually a loss of jobs in those fields in August, and September might be weak as well. Presumably, as we get past this latest surge, that demand will come back. People want to go out and eat again. But it's definitely something to watch. And you know, a lot of restaurant owners have said, look, we're going to have to do a better job of making these jobs more attractive to people. Mm-hmm. They've traditionally not been low wage jobs. They've been fairly high stress jobs. They have irregular schedules. It's a huge employer traditionally, but they may have to do some rethinking about how they structure those jobs if they want to attract a workforce.
Sarah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, so if I hear you right, and I have heard these arguments, is that then we're likely to see some cost push in the service sectors, because if they have to consistently raise wages for these workers, then that's going to be another component of the price index, which is going to see an increase beyond what we might be used to.
We've seen strong wage gains in those sectors, but this might be one of those areas where, you know, okay, you've gone from paying $10 or $12 an hour to $15 an hour. but you're probably not going to continue to ratchet up. So that was a price pressure, but it's not going to be an ongoing price pressure that's going to contribute to inflation going forward.
And we are seeing this. We are seeing this in other areas of the economy as well. For the longest time, and I guess during this period where we had relatively little inflation, we also had not a lot of pressure to increase wages. Now we do have this pressure to increase wages. So we've shuffled the deck, I guess, in a way, in the economy. Had it not been for the pandemic, would we be here today? Would we be having this conversation? Would we have any inflation whatsoever?
I think not nearly to the extent that we're seeing now. So I think we were starting to see some more wage pressures. You had a very tight labor market as we were heading into the pandemic. So unemployment kind of vacillating between 3.6%. And so we were starting to see some wage pressures, but there was still a lot of hesitancy on the part of businesses to raise prices. So I think there was still some concern about the fragility of the consumer and whether the consumer would leave them for other businesses if they raised prices too much. And it seems like the pandemic has really broken that spell where businesses have been forced to raise prices because of these supply issues, because demand has been so overwhelming, they have been able to without losing customers. In fact, you know, for many businesses, they can't even meet demand right now. And so that's basically broken that cycle to some extent where businesses are once again comfortable raising prices, at least to some extent. I think in terms of the wage issue, this goes back to something Scott said earlier in terms of we've seen some pretty big jumps in prices, and that includes some input costs like labor. But I think a big question going forward is how much do wages and input costs continue to rise? Is this a level shift upwards, or are we expecting this rate of change to continue?
And Doctor, let's go back to what you were talking about, the pressure on inflation imposed by rising wages or the rising demand for higher wages. Is there a relationship that you can point to? In other words, if we go from $12 to $15 an hour, are we going to see prices go up by a similar percentage rate, or is it completely dependent on the industry and the sector, et cetera?
Was that question directed at me?
Yes.
Yeah. We never see a full pass through of wages to prices. So it'll always be a lower increase in prices relative to input cost increases. But I think, you know, again, this isn't something probably all of us are going to struggle with during these conversation. Is this distinction between, and Sarah mentioned this, the distinction between the level change, just a jump up in prices, and thereafter prices don't really grow and therefore inflation is zero in the extreme, or is it an ongoing increase? And I think that, you know, that this is the question that everybody is struggling with, yeah, including the Federal Reserve and others. You know, the data that I recently looked at in preparation for this talk suggests to me a kind of moderation happening. I don't see an acceleration really big in terms of prices. There's one-off kinds of things. And as Scott was talking about, you see this fluctuation in prices. And my personal opinion is that this is primarily a level shift, all other things the same. We have things in the background going on that could change that, right, with regard to government policy and these kinds of things. But I would think that this is really a sort of post-pandemic, in some sense, related with a more of a level change. It's going to extend a little longer than I originally thought, but we can talk about that later.
Dr. Harry Bowen is a professor of economics at Queen's University of Charlotte. He's here with Sarah House from Wells Fargo and Scott Horsley from NPR. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about inflation, where it's coming from, where it's going, where it's headed. with Scott Horsley, Chief Economics Correspondent for NPR, Sarah House, Senior Economist at Wells Fargo, and Dr. Harry Bowen, Professor of Economics at Queen's University of Charlotte. When the economy was in the doldrums during the pandemic, we had conversations about what was going to happen to the economy, Scott, and economists told me that there was going to be this period of pent-up demand once things started to reopen, and that might cause a little inflation here as we got the supply chain back into gear. But the Federal Reserve seemed to have been caught off guard by this, because now they're saying that they think inflation will run hotter than previously predicted. Why were they caught off guard by this?
Well, you're right. The Fed has had to revise its forecast up several times this year, and each time they've seen inflation being higher and lasting longer than they expected. One thing Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said at his most recent news conference is that the supply chain disruptions have been larger and longer lasting than anticipated. Part of that has to do with what folks are spending money on. You know, during the pandemic, when a lot of us were in some semblance of lockdown, we weren't traveling, we weren't going out to live entertainment, we weren't eating a whole lot of restaurant meals in restaurants. So we were sitting at our computers ordering a bunch of stuff. And the spending on goods soared while spending on services dropped. And there's been an expectation that that would reverse, and that we would go back to traveling and eating out and going to concerts and ball games, and our spending on goods would fall back to something more normal. And that kind of started to happen at the beginning of the summer, but then with the Delta rise, that reversion to sort of normal spending patterns kind of stalled out. And we just got consumer spending data for August last Friday. And it showed, for example, that once again, spending on goods rose faster than spending on services. And that's part of the reason we're seeing all these supply chain hiccups, is there's just a whole lot more stuff that's being purchased right now than in normal times. And it's kind of overwhelmed the cargo ships and the railroad cars and the trucks and all of that. And meanwhile, the service part has still not fully recovered. And of course, that's when we see that shift, we may see more inflation on the services side and less inflation on the goods side. But that's part of why these pattern the shift back, I think, is taking longer. And that's one reason I think the Fed's been surprised at just how long lasting these supply chain disruptions have been.
Dr. Bowen, go ahead, Sarah.
I was going to say another reason why the Fed's been caught off guard too is not just that it's taken longer to see that demand shift back towards services, but because part of that shift has been delayed by the rise of the Delta variant, it's also hindered supply chains getting fixed maybe as quickly as people would have expected had, you know, the worst of the pandemic really been over last winter, as I think a lot of people were hoping, if not maybe fully expecting. And we've seen in many ways different responses in different parts of the global economy. So for example, other countries have a much lower tolerance for COVID cases. And so for example, we saw when cases began to rise in China during the summer, with about 200 daily cases, they basically shut down one of the world's biggest ports for 3 weeks. And so that contributed to these bottlenecks that have been ongoing. So it's not just the demand side, but it's also the fact that supply continues to be hindered by the pandemic and by different countries' tolerance for case levels and their ability to produce and ship and just keep supply chains going right now.
According to the London-based research firm Capital Economics, the U.S., they say, may be heading into an era in which inflation remains significantly higher on average over the next decade. And that seems to fly, Dr. Bowen, in the face of what the Fed has been saying, at least about short-term prospects. Should we be concerned about long-term inflation, do you think?
Well, we should always be concerned about long-term inflation, but—
Well, is there a reason to be concerned about long-term?
Of what you're talking about. I personally tend to hold the view that most of this, or much of it, is related really to the supply side disruptions. We are seeing, you know, increases in demand in general. I noticed that the personal savings rate had dropped from a 26% back in, when I look at my data here in March of 2021, it last in August, it's at 9.4. So people have been, you know, saving, hoarding, so to speak, or not wanting to spend. And that seems to have that, I won't call it a floodgate, but that irrigation channel has been opened in the minds of people. So going back to your original comment about demand, I would say that demand is certainly playing a role. My colleagues mentioned the shift in how demand is happening in durable goods versus services. And remember that, you know, programs like this and general media and others espousing and raising concerns about longer term inflation can also generate people to want to go out and buy things now because they worry it's going to be more expensive in the future. So, you know, we have this idea of self-fulfilling prospects. And I think that, you know, those things will meet a hard reality at some point unless there's something that accommodates the increases. And that's where I go back to current government policy. We're seeing that the Fed is seems to be signaling that maybe they want to start to have some restraint in what they're doing. I think they're kind of holding their cards close to their chest and they're still waiting to kind of see because, you know, we're trying to sort through this idea of, is there some ongoing mechanism that's going to keep generating price increases in the future? Or is this really a kind of one-off? So yeah. And I know that that you know this and my colleagues certainly know this, but I would impress upon our listeners that there really is a difference between the idea that the price level is shifting up over a period of time and reaching a new level thereafter, not necessarily increasing. So during that time period, we call that inflation, but to you know, economists and others, we really understand the difference between a price level shift. Getting there has to mean the price level rises, but thereafter it doesn't have to. So, you know, this is a very important distinction and why, in my view, looking at the data, and of course I could be wrong, I just see that, I don't see this going, I hate to make a time period thing, but I would say, you know, next summer, you know, we'll definitely be clear as to what's going on, if not a bit sooner. But I don't see, in the absence of anything right now, that we would have a sustained rate of inflation, the rate of price increase growing and growing and growing. I just don't see it.
So you're on the same page, essentially, with the Fed. Scott, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And the Fed, for years and years before the pandemic, was concerned that inflation was below its 2% target. And if the inflationary threat is people rush out to spend something before the price goes up, when inflation's too low, the problem is people don't go out and spend because they think if I wait 6 months or a year, it might be even cheaper. And that can be its own pernicious effect. So the Fed's actually, you know, up until the pandemic was trying to goose inflation a little bit higher. And in fact, a year ago, they adopted this new policy where they basically said, we're going to tolerate higher inflation. We're not going to raise interest rates preemptively to ward off inflation because we really want to encourage something like full employment. And that policy is going to be tested if they are now, you know, faced with an extended period of inflation that's much hotter. Their credibility, as Sarah referred to it, is going to be tested here. It's been tested in both ways, you know. But they have basically said we're not going to raise rates till we see the whites of inflation's eyes. Well, they're kind of seeing it right now. It's just a question of how long it sticks around.
Sarah, I want to go back to the supply chain issues that you talked about a second ago. Initially, the supply chain was disrupted for all kinds of reasons, including illness and shutdowns and people not being available to work, or et cetera. But they continue. These supply chain issues continue. Is it basically because jobs are going unfilled? We have all these container ships off the West Coast right now, and they can't be unloaded, partly because there are not enough dock workers or truck drivers to haul the stuff away once they are unloaded. How much of it has to do with that, and how much of it has to do with the fact that years ago, a lot of companies went to just-in-time inventory as opposed to warehousing parts and things like that. They had to, they were made just in time to arrive at the factory when they were needed to install. And that's no longer working. How much of it has to do with that?
So it's both. So when we look at the labor shortages in the transportation industry, for example, or loading and stocking positions. So Indeed Hiring does a great job of tracking these openings. And in those industries, they're up about 80% versus their pre-COVID baseline. So that compares to about 40% for all jobs. So you've seen some acute shortages in these industries. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we did see such a big pivot in where the activity in the economy is right now. So you're having to get people to essentially change careers to fill those. So that's a big part of it. But you're right, this does go back to the fact that for decades we were moving towards this just-in-time inventory. So businesses leveraging technology to basically have those parts show up right before they were needed in the factory or right before they expected consumers to buy them. And so they didn't have a lot on hand. And because of that, we're seeing ongoing part shortages, as you know, we've seen these bottlenecks in terms of shipping. Even once it gets to the port, it's having trouble getting off the premises. And so it's compounding. And we think this is a big change where, you know, going back to your question about, well, are we entering a period of higher inflation even after this? You know, there's a long way to go between what the Fed was dealing with in the past cycle, where it was trying to get inflation up to 2% versus the 5% we're seeing today now. So you could still have higher inflation than the last period, but not be nearly as pernicious as what we're seeing right now. And I think part of that does have to go to the shift in companies maybe changing their inventory models a little bit, de-risking, so holding more stocks, maybe producing or having their suppliers more diversified, closer to home, so they don't get into this. But that de-risking is going to come at a cost. And so that's going to limit future cost savings and maybe lead to a slightly higher rate of inflation than what we saw in the past cycle. But that doesn't mean we're going to be dealing with these 5% inflation numbers, I think, you know, well into next year or even 2023.
Are you saying that some of these companies that make things that have been using this just-in-time inventory strategy are rethinking that they'll go back to stocking warehouses with parts in the future?
They are at least critical parts. You know, you don't need to hold everything, but we've seen, you know, just all it takes is one part, you know, like semiconductors, which very important component, but the lead time on producing those can be years. And yeah. So for those items that can't quickly catch up, you might need to hold higher inventories of those items.
Dr. Bowen,
you know, as Sarah said earlier, globalization has been one of the factors historically keeping a lid on inflation. If we as a country decide we want to have more of our supply chain close at hand, and I'm frankly skeptical how much reshoring we may actually see, but to the extent we do see more of those supply chains moving back to domestic, that will, as Sarah says, lead to higher prices, and that'll be something to consider. You might have more security, but you also be paying a price for it.
It might not even be the onshoring, but just no longer offshoring itself could be a factor there.
Dr. Bowen, Morgan Stanley Asia Chairman Stephen Roach told CNBC that what we are experiencing with our supply chain issues today is eerily reminiscent, strikingly reminiscent was his word, of what we saw in the early 1970s. Is that an apt comparison? And for those people who were not around in the 1970s, remind us of what that resulted at the consumer level.
Well, the supply disruption, I presume he's talking about in the 70s, was primarily related to oil, and that was not so much a supply disruption related to a pandemic. It was a disease invoked by OPEC when they decided to cartelize and act like a monopolist and suddenly raise the price of oil. And that caught us significantly by surprise. And that caused a substantial increase in the price of oil, which is used in many industries and therefore filtered through to an increase. But I think that others would also point that alongside that increase in the price of oil and with it the price of other goods, that there must have been something to help generate an ongoing inflation in the 70s to allow consumers at higher prices to continue to buy pretty much what they had bought before. And that brings us back to monetary policy. So during the 1970s, we had substantial increases in the money supply, which was accommodating, as we would say, this reduced spending ability on the part of consumers because prices are going up. But if I give you more money, right, then you can continue to buy what is now a higher price, and that just continues to generate ongoing increases in prices, which what's led us into the 1980s, which Sarah mentioned, and that's when Volcker came in and put the brakes on the money supply and generated a substantial recession in the United States, which broke the back of inflation. And since then, the central bank has had a little halo around it, where it's felt that, well, they can easily control this thing. And I question a little bit the idea of having a fine-tuning notion of the central bank in terms of being able to, you know, fine-tune these little adjustments and things. And the only thing, you know, that I would say, going back to the other question on the Fed and what is it going to do and what is it thinking about, is it could be that the Fed has a kind of, and it doesn't want to, but it may have a knee-jerk reaction where it actually pulls back too soon. And, you know, I think in the history, and I'll go to my colleagues here, but I think in the history of monetary policy, we tend to see that monetary policy in terms of trying to adjust the levers to keep prices and employment where you'd like them to be, tend to operate with a lag. They tend to be pro-cyclical when we're coming out of these dips and things. So in that context, what that means is that the Fed is likely to be more stimulative when it, at a time when, in fact, it should be restraining. So we'll see what happens here. And if it's more stimulative than it should be at this time, in this juncture, then we could see a period again of increases in the rate of inflation until those restraints bite and then would go down.
There are shortages in various different sectors, from new cars and semiconductors for those new cars to paper towels again. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Harry Bowen, who is a professor of economics at Queen's University of Charlotte. Sarah House is a senior economist at Wells Fargo. And Scott Horsley is the chief economics correspondent at NPR. We just mentioned, Scott, that new cars are in short supply largely because of the lack of availability of semiconductors, because all these cars now run on computers. Although there is some complaint about they're not modernizing the semiconductors that they're using. That's a whole nother topic. Plastic is also abundant in cars, and it's in short supply, as is cardboard. And recently was announced that Costco, once again, is rationing toilet paper and paper towels. Why these sectors? What's going on here?
Well, I think with the plastic, a lot of that has to do with both, you know, a lot of plastic is produced along the Gulf Coast. And so there was some side effect from the recent tropical storms there. And I think we're still dealing with the after effects of the deep freeze last February, which idled a lot of plastic producers. In fact, I was talking to a domestic toy maker the other day who was talking about the challenges of getting the resins that he uses in his plastic toys. And it's very frustrating for him because, you know, while his competitors, most of whom have their toys produced in China, they're waiting for these cargo containers to cross the Pacific. He says, this could have been a golden opportunity for me to take some market share from my competitors, but I can't get the resin. So, I mean, he can get it a little bit at a time. He's doing the best he can, but you know, that's just one example. We see this repeated over and over again. I'm not sure exactly what the problem is with cardboard, although I suspect it has a lot to do with transportation. You know, everything gets where it's going by truck, and in some cases by rail, and if it's coming from overseas by ship. But the trucking system has certainly been overwhelmed. The rail system has been overwhelmed. We've talked about the cargo ships stacked up. The West Coast ports have been stacked up. I think now that some of the Gulf Coast and East Coast ports are starting to see more traffic. So it's just you're trying to push 12 lanes of traffic through a 4-lane highway, and it's pretty tough to do.
Well, we're about 11 weeks away from Christmas, Sarah. Something like that. For those of you who have not started your shopping, I keep seeing these stories on the TV news that say, if you haven't bought it yet, you better buy it because it may not be here for Black Friday because of the bottlenecks that we've been talking about. If you can't get stuff for Christmas and retailers really depend on the holiday season to make their year, what impact, Sarah, would that have on the economy, et cetera?
Well, I think what we're seeing in terms of these supply issues, it boils down to the fact that growth could be even stronger right now. So in the first half of the year, we saw GDP of roughly 6.5%. That's remarkable considering, the economy's underlying run rate, but it could have been even stronger if we weren't having to dip into inventories as much as we have. So I think what you're going to see happen is, businesses and retailers, there's going to be less discounting. And so they're going to try and make up some of those profits by, somewhat higher price because they're not able to move as much volume because of these supply issues.
But I mean, if you really can't get, if Santa can't deliver, let's put it that way, what does that mean for Macy's? What does it mean for mom and dad? What does it mean for kids? What does it mean?
Well, for any kids listening, Santa will deliver, promise.
Maybe in February.
Perhaps. But again, I think it goes to a profit squeeze or not being able to capitalize as much on these opportunities of this remarkably strong demand. Going piggybacking on both what Scott and Harry have said is that, consumers are in great shape right now. We've talked about the saving rate, how it still remains well above what it was going into the pandemic. So consumers are still putting away more money each month than they would be otherwise. And so you're still seeing savings accumulate, giving them a lot of spending power. But if there's nothing on the shelves, if the inventories aren't there, it's probably going to be a smaller Christmas and holiday season for many.
And jobs.
Some of those forecasters who downgraded their forecast for the second half of this year, GDP growth, have upgraded their forecast for 2022. So some of this is a case of spending that just gets postponed. Some of it, though, is spending that doesn't happen. You might put off the purchase of a new dishwasher because you're waiting for the model you want that's also waiting for a chip or something. But the restaurant meal you didn't get on a Friday night, you're not going to make that up.
Scott, jobs are waiting to be filled. That's part of the problem with the supply chain, in fact, that they can't get enough truck drivers to drive the cargo. How much of the difficulty that we're experiencing with this are the federal programs that came in and supported these workers during the height of the pandemic that also put them off from being evicted because they couldn't pay their rent as a result? How much of it has to do with that versus people reevaluating their career choices now that they've had 18 months at home and not having to get up early and not having to commute to work and thinking, hey, this is much better than what I was going through before? How much of it has to do with that? Or how much of it has to do with frontline workers who still don't feel safe interfacing with customers who are not masked or who are unvaccinated?
I think it's all of those factors, and trying to weight them is challenging. I do think a lot of economists assumed that the supplemental unemployment benefits, it started out being $600, and then it went to $300, and we also greatly expanded eligibility for unemployment benefits, for example. Plus, there was the stimulus payments that pretty much everybody got. There was a lot of federal money that was put out into people's pocketbooks over the last 18 months. I think economists did feel like a lot of that gave people more freedom to hold out for a better job or to hold out for, you know, better working conditions at their old job and so forth. It is interesting, over the summer when we ran that experiment where half the states cut off the supplemental benefits early and half of them kept paying till the beginning of September, it didn't have as big an effect as I think some employers thought it was going to have when those benefits ran out. Now, we'll see. The benefits have now expired nationwide as of early September. At the beginning of September, some 6 or 7 million people fell off the unemployment rolls. How quickly will they return to the workforce? We'll be watching that in the months to come. This Friday, we'll get the September jobs numbers. I think people expect it to be a little bit better than August, but not as strong as it was in June and July. So we're still seeing fallout, I think, from the rise of the Delta variant. We'll get some improvement as kids go back to school, and that frees up parents to go back to work. But maybe that's not been the godsend that we were hoping for, because people are still uncertain about whether the school's going to stay open. So it's just taking a lot longer to heal the wound in our job market that this pandemic has done than we would like. Ultimately, it will heal, but as you say, a lot of people they've had some time to think, they've had some time to reflect on what matters to them. They may make some different decisions about how they want to live and work.
And modern society seems to be, at least on the surface, a well-oiled machine. But what this has proven to show us is that you put a little water in that oil and things are going to get choppy for a while or dicey for a while. Harry, the Fed has revised down their prediction of economic growth. They've moved the needle from a predicted 7% growth in GDP to 5.9%. That doesn't sound like a lot, is it?
You mean as a reduction? Well, yeah. I think I'm actually spectacular. I think even a 5.7% increase in real GDP is pretty amazing. Look at our fellow countries around the world. And of course, we can always point to Europe as a lagger. But I think I want to come back to what something Scott just said. And that's something that we haven't really talked about. And that is the climate of uncertainty that exists right now in the economy. So, we have these things where we're being buffeted by COVID that and COVID this, and schools open and schools close, and students get quarantined. And there's just a lot of uncertainty, I think, in the minds of us, the people. And so when there's uncertainty, you tend to restrain a bit what's going on. So people will go out and try to have more restaurant meals and do these kinds of things. But I think a lot of people just at the moment are just uncertain. They're not really still sure where things are kind of going here. And so that's got to be something that puts some restraint on what's going on in the economy. And that may be part of the reduction in the forecast for what real GDP growth would be going forward. But I'll live in an economy anytime that's growing at 5.5-6% real per year. That is really phenomenal. It just shows you actually the strength of the U.S. economy. And I think imagine what we would have if we didn't have these bottlenecks. I mean, we could be at 9-10% growth. We'd be in the decades of Japan and China, with going from very small bases, growing enormously. So I'm not worried about revising real GDP growth down from 6.2% to 5.7%. I see that as, well, it'd be nice if we could grow more, but we don't want the price increases that might come with that. But we're actually doing very well, all things considered.
One clearly evident place to look for reaction to uncertainty is the stock market, Sarah. And in recent weeks, the stock market has been roiled by events in China, by our own Congress and their maneuvers to try to pass Joe Biden's infrastructure plan and even keep the government open. The stock market is not the economy, but surely those events and the roiling of the market have a psychological impact on ordinary people who maybe don't have a lot of money in the market at the moment, or have a 401k that they'll depend on in 40 years, but right now things are okay. What is the impact of all this uncertainty on the market and on people who are depending upon those investments for their retirement?
Well, I think so as you mentioned, the stock market is not the economy, but it can play into consumer confidence. So we see in terms of what drives consumer confidence, some of the biggest factors are what's happening in the stock market and what's happening with gas prices. So very much linked to what's playing out in terms of inflation. And so when we look at the overall environment, like right now you say some of the volatility has been driven by, you know, we have a number of different things going on in DC. So, you know, we barely avoided a shutdown, you know, we're dealing with this debt ceiling. And so I think there's a lot of different factors playing into that. But I think right now in many ways, what could be hitting consumer confidence has been more of these inflation numbers that we've seen, the increased media reports about it. If you dig into some of the buying plans, you do see people beginning to step back away or signaling that they won't be purchasing as many large big ticket items, in part because the prices have gotten so high. And so I think we are seeing some of these inflation effects that we've been talking about. It has become in many ways a negative risk to the outlook, even as we've been talking about, growth overall remains exceptionally strong, but it is whittling down that overall pace of growth.
Scott, former President Jimmy Carter just celebrated his 97th birthday. So let's go back to the 1970s and even prior to Jimmy Carter, perhaps Gerald Ford. We had periods of high unemployment. We had periods of rising inflation. We called it stagflation. We have some of the similar situations going on right now. Are we heading into another period of stagflation?
I hope not, because I did live through that period.
Yes.
It was not good for any of us. I think there are a lot of differences. Sarah's alluded to some of them, and Harry talked about, you know, what the precipitating event for a lot of that was, the oil shock in 73, mm-hmm. and then another oil shock in 79. One good piece of news, you know, our economy is much less dependent on oil than it was in those days. We're much less energy intensive overall. So, you know, the price of oil can move pretty dramatically and not take the toll on the economy that it did back in the 1970s. I suppose we're much more chip intensive though than we were in the 1970s. I don't think auto plants would have shut down in the 1970s for want of computer chips, at least not to the degree they are now. So, you know, we're less vulnerable to some old things. We're more vulnerable to some new things. One of the things the Fed talks about a lot is the wage price spiral that we got into the 70s, where the expectation was that prices were going to keep ratcheting up. So consumers insisted on getting, or workers insisted on getting higher wages. And you had wages and prices kind of going up in a stair step. So far, it doesn't look like we're going to see a repeat of that. Even though consumer expectations of inflation are a little bit higher, the market expectations and the professional forecasters' expectations are more or less in line with the Fed. This is a temporary thing. So I don't think we're going to have a 1970s style runaway price spike, but that threat is always there. And what it takes to control it is so painful, you really want to avoid it.
I have less than a minute left here, but we have all these things going on in the Congress right now. They just voted to keep the government open. They're deadlocked over the infrastructure bill. They're trying to decide among Democrats exactly how much money to give to the care economy bill, for lack of a better term. Even if that bill is $1.5 trillion as opposed to the $3 point something that the president is suggesting, what would the long-term effects on consumers be, Harry Bowen?
Ooh, man. Okay, that's a
very quickly.
I would say that a lot from my perspective, and again, in the topic we've been talking about of inflation and these things, is that a lot of it has to do with how this stuff, how if it passed, how it would be financed. Certainly, the recipients of the government largess would be happy, right? But on the other hand, where is the money going to come from? So somebody is going to be unhappy if, in fact, it comes to taxes. Shareholders will, of course, be unhappy. That's kind of the best I can say at the moment.
In the time allotted. And so I guess this too shall pass is the message we shall take from this conversation today. Harry Bowen, professor of economics at Queen's University of Charlotte, Sarah House, senior economist with Wells Fargo, and Scott Horsley with NPR. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.